The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Sorry to disappoint, but I'm afraid this is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. I think he's getting ready for our big public appearance campaign coming up on Sunday and Monday. Well, lots of interesting news that we'll talk about today. Why Germany is beefing up its military, a headline from the BBC this morning. Not a place I guess we normally get intriguing headlines from. Also, if we get time, we've talked before about how the Catholic Church is facing its biggest crisis since the Protestant Reformation with the child abuse scandal. Well, now there's another major event hitting the global Christian community, and another very significant once in several hundred years event. I'm also joined on today's show by a wasp. Ironically enough, it's hiding in our fly trap, so if you hear some buzzing, it's not, well, I hope it's not the audio equipment malfunctioning. It's probably our special guest on today's show. But first of all, I want to talk about quite a few stories that have come out over the first few days on militarization in Asia. One eye-catching piece of news especially comes from Japan. Japanese armored vehicles were deployed overseas just a few days ago for the first time since World War II. So another almost epochal event. On October 13th, Japan took part in military exercises in the Philippines. That was a lot. They were doing that alongside the US and the Filipino military. And they had 150 Marines storm a beach there, which is interesting because Japan's constitution said, well, it says the nation is pacifist. It says that the Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation, and that the threat or use of force as a means of settling international disputes. It also says that land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained. That's still the law. That's still the Japanese constitution. But you've got not just an army, but practicing storming a beach, which is not really the most defensive of military operations. And this slow shift away from that constitution from Japan really is remarkable. In 1954, they founded their self-defense forces. So you saw there, it says that land, sea, and air forces will never be maintained. Japan isn't allowed an army. So instead, they said, well, we've got self-defense forces. It's not an army, it's a self-defense force. By now, it's estimated to be about the fifth most powerful military in the world. But there you go, self-defense force, purely defensive. And then they've gradually wrapped it up to the point that you've got storming beaches with Marines, which it's very hard to storm a beach defensively. Even these Marines, they're part of the Amphibious Rapid Deployment Unit, which Japan has only just brought out. Again, because anything like Marines that are typically offensive capability, they've not had in the past. But they're shifting away from that. They're even, well, we'll get to that in a minute, but they're even getting ready now to change their constitution because it quite obviously is a bit of a farce where you have this constitution that says you can have no army and then you've got the world's fifth most powerful army. CNN also had an article this week on exactly that subject. I forgot to write down the title, but it was something along the lines of why the Japanese military is more visible, why you're seeing the Japanese military doing more around the world. And they wrote, when tanks rolled and troops marched at a Japanese military base on Sunday, it was just the latest in what analysts say is a campaign by Tokyo to increase the profile of its self-defense forces. Presiding over the display involving 4,000 troops, dozens of pieces of armor and warplanes, including its newest F-35 stealth fighters, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe touted Japan's relationships extending as far as Europe. So that's some quite far-fledged defense relationships. And they're upping the profile, making their self-defense forces more public. Shinzo Abe, he said, he was talking to the soldiers, and he said, you're working on warning and surveillance activities, cooperating with allies, countries such as the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, New Zealand. They wrote, Japan's military has been making its presence known thousands of miles from its home islands this year, in what analysts say is intended to send a clear signal to China. So again, not very defensive, practicing deploying thousands of miles away. This article continues, in just the past 2 months, a naval force of three ships, including the 27-ton helicopter destroyer, and even that, it's called a helicopter destroyer. The only reason it's not an aircraft carrier is that Japan hasn't put planes on it. It is an aircraft carrier. It is perfectly capable of carrying fighter planes or with a few modifications. They've just called it a helicopter carrier and put helicopters on it. It could change at a moment's notice. But they're not allowed to have aircraft carriers. But they say, okay, well, we're allowed to have this one because it's not called an aircraft carrier. But anyway, to get on with this article, this has been on 2 months of exercises and port visits as far away as the Indian Ocean. So practicing getting aircraft carriers all the way to the Indian Ocean. Not really a very defensive maneuver there. Along the exercises was an anti-submarine warfare drill, CNN continues, in the South China Sea that included one of Tokyo's submarines. It was the first time Japan had acknowledged using a submarine in a drill in the contested sea. It goes on to write that meanwhile, Japan's ships on the naval deployment included visits to India, Sri Lanka, Singapore, and the Philippines, as well as drills with a British frigate in the Indian Ocean. And then it goes on to talk about this Japanese amphibious warfare is operated on foreign soil for the first time since World War II. And as I said, this is making the Constitution look pretty ridiculous, so they're planning on changing it by 2020. And this is just one headline on the subject. There's been a few recently, just even on this subject of Japan militarizing. Here's another one. This was from Popular Mechanics. Japan is developing a unique supersonic glide weapon. They write, Japan's military, which has spent decades focused solely on self-defense, is making a new kind of weapon to deliver an explosive payload at supersonic speeds. The unconventional tech is designed to soften up enemy defenses with precision strikes before Japanese marines hit the beach. They say that the high-speed guiding missile fills the holes of long-range precision attack in Japan's defense capabilities. The weapon consists of two stages, a booster rocket stage, which accelerates it to supersonic speeds, and a second aerodynamic warhead. Well, anyway, it goes through some of the details and talks about how new it is that other nations don't have anything quite like this that can move so fast. It sounds a lot like a boost glide hypersonic weapon system. So something that moves very fast and is very maneuverable. This article continues, since the end of World War II, Japan's defense-focused military has avoided anything resembling offensive military capabilities. Long-range missiles, bombers, aircraft carriers, and marines were all classified as offensive weapons and therefore off-limits. Times are changing, and Japan has just about all of those. Long-range missiles, that's what this article's talking about. F-35s can be used as bombers, and that's the next headline I was going to mention. Then you've got aircraft carriers. We mentioned their helicopter carrier that is not an aircraft carrier, honest, only because it doesn't actually have any aeroplanes on it right now, and marines that they've got now as well. So yeah, that other story I was going to mention that I just preempted myself slightly with, more F-35As eyed to counter China. And that just mentioned that the government is talking about buying an extra 20 F-35 stealth fighter jets. That's another squadron of them. So why watch this? Why be concerned with these headlines from Japan militarizing? Well, Jeremiah Jacques has an article, one of the trends articles, that just goes into the background of why we're watching these stories on our website. And in that he wrote, in light of Japan's wartime history, all of these steps towards nationalism and militarism are worthy of attention and concern. Adding to the concern is the fact that Japan is notorious for failing to express much remorse for its wartime savagery. Japan has also revised history in many cases to downplay its crimes. The people of Japan embody many exceptional, noble, and admirable traits. Their cultural and technological contributions have enriched the human experience for millions around the globe. But as a result of historical revisionism, a dangerous number of modern Japanese view their nation's wartime atrocities with pride. This is a foreboding and worrisome trend. So you have Japan building up its military. At the same time, you have this rewriting of history. We'll play a quick soundbite that talks a bit about some of that from that Vox News made last year, talking about this alarming trend in Japan.
While I was in Japan, I got my hands on a Japanese history textbook. But this isn't an ordinary Japanese textbook. It's a very political one. And if you look inside, you'll see a version of history that is very different than the one the world knows. An example is the Nanking Massacre, the 1938 event in which Japanese troops murdered tens of thousands of Chinese civilians. To the world, this massacre is considered one of the most infamous war crimes committed by the Japanese during their takeover of Asia. But in this textbook, it basically gets no attention. It's referred to as the Nanking Incident. And the only attention it gets in this book is basically disputing the facts. There's no mention of the hundreds of thousands of Korean women who were forcibly brought over to serve in brothels on the front lines of the Japanese wars. These comfort women that are a huge part of Japanese history, but they don't show up in this book. When I was in Tokyo for a border story, I actually visited the people who publish and write this book. It's this group of old Japanese men who are part of this lobbying society that basically try to push a different historical narrative into Japanese schools, and they've been quite successful. This textbook publishing society is one of many expressions of a rising nationalism in Japan.
So just one of many expressions of a rising nationalism in Japan, and at the same time that they're pushing this, well, we did nothing wrong in World War II and these atrocities, they're teaching these young people sometimes nothing about these atrocities, sometimes, oh, they're exaggerated. At the same time, you see Japan's military returning to normal. And that's one big reason to watch this. But another very important one is this trend is powerful proof of Bible prophecy. Herbert W. Armstrong was saying that Japan would remilitarize. Here's one example, a quote all the way back from 1971. Japan today has no military establishment, he wrote, but we should not lose sight of the fact that Japan has become so powerful economically that it could build a military force of very great power very rapidly. And he talked about this for decades. Even today, Japan spends, I think it's just about 1% of its economy on its military. As a percentage of its economy, it's pretty small. But Japan's economy is so huge that that still adds up to a very significant size. And I think it is about the fifth best funded military in the world. You start spending a similar percentage to what the US spends, and you've got a very powerful military indeed. So even today, Japan, they could grow that pretty quickly by just spending, say, a normal nation's amount on its military. So why did Mr. Armstrong forecast this? Well, we'll come to that in just a minute, but we'll talk about a few more headlines. Again, this from Asia, we've got another head. This was, well, Japan-India, from the diplomat, Japan-India Maritime Exercises 2018. On these military exercises Japan was doing with India. Another headline, what's in China's military exercises with Malaysia and Thailand? So you've got other military alliances within Asia. They talked about that these military exercises spotlight China's efforts to boost security ties with the two Southeast Asian states as part of their wider relationship, even amid lingering concerns about aspects of Beijing's behavior in the region. While it was not officially characterized as such, the exercises, as outlined, effectively constituted part of an ongoing expansion of the China-Malaysia exercise series. So China's building its alliances. Another headline from the diplomat over the last week, Pakistan-Russia to hold joint military exercises. The Pakistani and Russian militaries will conduct a joint military exercise dubbed Friendship 2080. I love that title for a military exercise. All right, we're going to practice with our armies and we're going to call it Friendship 2018. I guess it sounds like they should be armed with flowers rather than guns for something like that. Just to continue with this quote, involving 200 troops from both countries in Pakistan's northern highlands from October 21st to November 4th. So pretty small military exercise, just 200 troops. But so you've got Russia, Pakistan drawing closer together. So you've got lots of these military alliances building and in the mix within Asia. Of course, the biggest one that's really developing right now before our eyes, and we had some really good stories over the last week on that, is the Russia-China alliance. So you've got these rising militarizations of some of these nations, and then these building alliances. You might, last time I was on this show, I think it was last time, back before our break, we were talking about these largest ever, quite possibly, military exercises in the history of the world that were going on, that Russia was conducting, that China had been invited to and sent several thousand troops to in Russia. A Real Clear World published an update on these exercises from the Heritage Foundation earlier in the week on the implications of these world's largest military exercises going on between these two powers. This article states it should have gotten more attention, but it seemingly did not. On September 11th, while Russia President Vladimir Putin warmly greeted his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping at the Eastern Economic Forum in Vladivostok, their armed forces held war games in Russia's Far East Military District. Though Vostok 2018 may have been Russia's largest military exercises in decades, two issues really stood out: a unique level of Sino-Russian military cooperation and the possible strategic implications for the United States in the Pacific region. And, well, we've got also brought a couple of sound bites from news reports, and this is what they really focused on as well, just how big of a demonstration this was of Russia and China's military alliance. Here's a clip. Again, I think this was from CNN.
This is Vostok 2018, which Russia calls its biggest war games since the fall of the Soviet Union. More than 300,000 troops, 36,000 vehicles, 1,000 aircraft, warships cruising offshore. The militaries from Russia, China, and Mongolia in a high-tech, heavily armored muscle flex. A massive, ambitious exercise staged by Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, who've come to Vladivostok to witness the event and send a signal to their joint rival.
Instead of letting this image of Russian-Chinese, you know, endless rivalry prevail, this is the Russians and the Chinese signaling, no, we're working together, stay out of our turf, America, Japan, South Korea, the West, right? We can handle things, we can defend ourselves.
Putin and Xi are enjoying this so much, they staged an event to make pancakes together, sprinkle them with caviar, and have a vodka toast.
I thought I'd add that little tidbit in at the end. Not particularly important, but you got some quite funny footage of the two of them making pancakes together. I mean, much more significant than two leaders eating pancakes is, and their personal relationship, is this growing military relationship between these two. And that message, as you heard, that they're sending, stay out of our region. We're working together, and we're strong enough to, we're practicing our military, we're strong enough to keep you out. Here's how CNN concluded that segment, again, just focusing on this alliance between Russia and China.
This friendship between Russia and China, certainly at the personal level, has been growing in years. Worrisome implications for the U.S.?
That's right, Jim. You know, Putin and Xi are said to be very close personal friends at the moment. Putin has clearly been, as they say, pivoting east in recent years, signing multi-billion dollar energy deals with China and other trade agreements. This is clearly developing now as an axis of power designed very clearly to challenge the United States. We'll see how the U.S. responds, especially in that Pacific region.
Brian Todd, thanks very much.
So an axis of power designed to threaten the United States, challenge the United States. Going back to this Heritage Foundation article, it says, of course, troops from different, usually friendly countries exercise together, and Russia and China have held many military exercises before. They said, however, what is deeply worrisome is that Vostok 2018 could provide China, which has not fought a war since its 1979 conflict with Vietnam, with a treasure trove of military knowledge about modern warfare. They also write that naturally Russia and China should be rivals considering their geography, e.g. long border and tumultuous history going back centuries. So they're looking at this, they're saying, well, if we were trying to forecast the future, we would have said these two would be enemies. They would be rivals. That's not what Herbert W. Armstrong said, and we'll get to that in a minute. Nevertheless, this article continues, they have also worked together to create a multipolar global world order to balance the preponderant power of the United States. Indeed, it could be argued that strategic cooperation between Beijing and Moscow has reached a new level as both capitals face deteriorating relations with Washington over a range of issues. They said that the military exercise is a reason for some alarm in that it signals a possible willingness by Beijing and Moscow to engage in greater political and military cooperation in the future if necessary. And last time we talked about this, one of the articles that we talked about basically said this is the closest you're going to get between these two nations having a formal military alliance. That's basically what they're putting on display here. But it's not just the military that is boosting the relationship between these two. It's not just a military relationship either. Oilprice.com, they had an article this week, "The Perfect Storm Bringing China and Russia Together." The Perfect Storm Bringing China and Russia Together. This was from Monday. And they wrote, "During the Cold War, China and the Soviet Union regarded one another as strategic adversaries. Relations between Beijing and Moscow, however, have significantly improved over the years. Besides political alignment, the countries have complementary economies. China has an insatiable appetite for the raw materials, which Russia has in abundance, and Beijing has the financial strength to protect Moscow against the sanctions related to its annexation of Crimea." That was surprisingly hard to say. "Bilateral trade, as a consequence, has increased dramatically over the years. At the end of 2017, it stood at $80 billion, an increase of 30% year-on-year, with an aim to reach $200 billion by 2024. Much of this growth will need to come from energy trade, of which natural gas will likely make up a large part. An example of this natural gas growth is the Power of Siberia pipeline, which is currently nearing completion, and the Altay pipeline project, which looks set to follow." And this is a big pipeline deal. Everything about this relationship is big. There's largest ever war games. I think this is one of the biggest ever pipeline projects. It's a $400 billion pipeline. And China and Russia are even accelerating their natural gas relationship. China's been using, as it tries to, it's got this big smog problem in its cities, and that's been causing a lot of unpopularity. So it's been trying to move away from the smog-polluting coal-type power stations and to do more with natural gas that burns more clearly, produces less smog. So they've been relying more on that. But then that's meant they've been importing liquefied natural gas from the United States. Now they find themselves in a trade war with the United States. And that import of liquid natural gas, they've decided, is a weakness. They're still relying on it. In fact, they tried to put tariffs on it, but then they withdrew the tariffs, indicating that they kind of needed that so much that they didn't want to keep tariffs on that natural gas they were bringing in from the United States. Natural gas is also, or liquefied natural gas, tends to be more expensive. So they're looking to Russia even more so for their energy needs now. Oilprice.com talked about this. They write, "Changing geopolitics have positively influenced political support for a second gas pipeline. Warming relations between China and Russia and cooling relations between China and the U.S. have increased the necessity for a stable source of energy. Also, predictions of Chinese gas consumption have been adjusted upwards, which has strengthened the need for Russian gas." So they're talking about building a second pipeline, and they're getting ready to start work on that, either through the Altay region or perhaps through Mongolia, which I think they've decided that might be an easier option. And so that you could see this energy relationship between Russia and China getting even closer. Meanwhile, well, I'll just talk about, this is one more story on a related subject, that even China and Japan might actually be getting on better. The Geopolitical Futures, their daily memo a couple of days ago, part of their headline was, "China makes nice with Japan." And they write, "In a landmark summit set to take place on October 26th, Chinese President Xi Jinping and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe are expected to sign several agreements covering everything from technological cooperation and intellectual property protections to avoiding conflict in the East China Sea. They also expected to revive and expand a currency swap agreement that expired in 2013 amid tensions over a disputed island chain. The intensity of this dispute has always been something of a barometer in their bilateral relations. And they finish off, both countries have been happy to ignore their grievances in periods where they need to cooperate on other issues. With the two countries under pressure from the US on trade, technology, currency, and defense matters, basically everything Xi and Abe expected to discuss, this is one such period. So China and Japan, they're not great friends, but under pressure, they're prepared to ignore their differences and their grievances, and that's something they're starting to do at the moment. So the alliance building here, when you look at them long term, and that's a huge turnaround for Russia and China, but even for all of these different Asian nations to come together. But this was something Herbert W. Armstrong saw as well. This rise in alliance in Asian nations, as well as this militarization that we talked about earlier. All the way back as early as the June-July 1934 issue of The Plain Truth, he wrote, "Two great military powers will arise in the last days. One, the revival of the Roman Empire by a federation of 10 nations in the territory of the ancient Roman Empire. The other, Russia with her allies, possibly China or Japan." That's all the way back, 1934, before even World War II. In 1959, where you had quite a lot of tensions between Russia and China, people in that general time period thought there might even be a war between Russia and China. The Plain Truth magazine, where Mr. Armstrong was editor-in-chief, he wrote, "Russia's program calls first for the seizure of Asia." It talked about how China would voluntarily submit to Russia's leadership in an Asian bloc as a step towards their long-term goals. The magazine wrote, "China's constant dream for centuries has been ultimate world conquest." But then they wrote, "China knows, however, that in this highly industrial age, she can accomplish this dream only as an ally of Russia. China is now ready to begin devouring the rest of Asia with Russia's secret military backing." And so they were talking about these two forming this relationship when tensions were very, very high. So why forecast the militarization of Japan? Why forecast these nations working together? Well, all of that comes from Bible prophecy. You'll often hear people, even in the news now, talking about Armageddon. A word that is used just a few times in the book of Revelation, comes from Revelation 16 and verse 16. Well, this same chapter talks about a group of individuals, rulers that it calls the kings of the east. Chapter 12 talks about that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. So who are these kings of the east? Well, Revelation 9 and verse 16 talks about these same kings. And it says that they have an army of 200 million. So where can you get an army of 200 million? Well, Asia's the best place to get that. China would be the best nation to have involved in India if you're looking at a 200 million man army. And even Russia, during World War, they don't have that high population, but you look at the percentage of their population they put under arms during World War II. A huge percentage. They could make a huge impact on this army, or put a huge amount of material and men towards building this army. Ezekiel chapter 38 also talks about an alliance of nations, and it starts to give you some idea of who's involved, starts naming some nations and who's involved in this massive alliance. It talks about it in Ezekiel chapter 38 and verse 2. It talks about Gog and Magog, and it talks about Meshech and Tubal. And you can start looking in some commentaries and things like that, and generally Gog and Magog that refers to northern Eurasia. Meshech is where you get eventually Moscow, Tobolsk. The Bible also talks about the Prince of Rosh, which is where we get the name Russia. Verse 6 talks about Gomer and Togarma. And these are ancient names for the people that make up Japan. So you see Japan, Russia, China talked about as being part of these kings of the East, being militarily powerful and having this alliance. In the Trends article that I mentioned earlier, Jeremiah says, "Today, animosity and distrust linger between the people of Japan and China. But what would the Japanese do if a fierce united European military destroyed their main ally, the United States? Would they wait to find out if they alone could stand up to this ferocious European power? Or would they desire to survive, prompt them to lay aside their differences with China and partner up with the Russo-Chinese bloc? Well, we've already seen how they're willing to lay aside their differences when they're under pressure." In such a scenario, Jeremiah writes, it's easy to see that the survival instinct would prompt the Japanese people to humble themselves between the Chinese and Russians and to lend their burgeoning military might to the Russo-Chinese axis. They would do so based on the belief that the alliance would only be temporary. And then he concludes that Trends article writing, the Bible makes plain that an Asian superpower will very soon rise up, and it tells us that the resulting war, thanks partly to the participation of the Japanese war machine, will be the most devastating one mankind will ever have endured. Christ described the coming Third World War, saying, "For there will be greater anguish than at any time since the world began, and it will be so great again, and it will never be so great again. In fact, unless this time of calamity is shortened, not a single person will survive." But then it goes on to say, the Bible goes on to say that time will be shortened. So this is where the militarization of Japan is leading, the unity or this alliance between Russia and China is leading. It shows we're getting close to that time. And it is, as you heard, a time of great suffering, but it will be shortened. This time leads right into the return of Jesus Christ, that time being shortened, suffering then being eliminated from the earth, man being taught the way to live in happiness and peace. And we've very quickly covered some scriptures there. If you want to really dig in, and if you haven't done so, I really encourage you to do that, to dig into these scriptures to prove what I've said to you. I mean, we've gone over this in 2-3 minutes, so we've not really dug in and proved these scriptures and really given you proof from the Bible that yes, Revelation 16 is referring to what we're seeing right now. Ezekiel 38 is referring to the same thing as Revelation 16. You know, I've not really proven that in what I've talked about, but the proof is there. And if you dig in and study it, you can prove that to yourself. We have a free book, Russia and China in Prophecy, that will go in much more detail and help you really prove that each of these scriptures applies to the news that we're seeing, to the headlines that we've covered, well, just in the last half an hour or so. So if you've not read that book, I'd really urge you to go and read that. You can read it online at thetrumpet.com. You can also write to your print for your free, or not even write, just fill in an online form and get sent to you your free print copy of this booklet. And that's the option I'd really urge you to go with if you've not proved this, because then you can get it out with your Bible, get a highlighter, really digest it in print rather than just skimming it on the screen, and prove this to yourself. Prove where these world events are leading, and that they are indeed, that the Bible does say that these events really are leading to the return of Jesus Christ, because this is something that you can prove. So you can get that book and get much more detail on this subject at thetrumpet.com. Well, we'll take a short break now. When we get back, we'll talk about that headline I mentioned earlier from the BBC, "Why is Germany beefing up its military?"
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. America's status as the world's lone superpower is rapidly fading. Other nations and groups of nations are angling to fill the void. Rising in the East is an emerging power block of tremendous potential in manpower, economic heft, and military might. Its growing presence is intensifying global competition for resources and for geopolitical influence. Where will this trend lead? What does this mean for you? Biblical prophecy provides a remarkable, penetrating preview of Asia's future. Request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. This book exposes in startling detail what Russia and China are doing and will do, and how they will affect your life. Also, you'll be sent a free one-year subscription to The Trumpet magazine. The Trumpet looks at today's headlines through the clear light of Bible prophecy. The Trumpet will keep you up to date on the continuing rise of the powers in the East by taking a hard look at today's news and comparing it to the prophecies of the Bible. The Trumpet magazine is this world's most informed news magazine. To learn more, request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. Act today and request Russia and China in Prophecy. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Well, welcome back to The Trumpet Daily radio show. This is, as I mentioned, Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, coming to you from Edstone, England. I'll give you a quick update on the status of our guest here in the studio with us, the Wasp. He's still around, but he appears to have gone to sleep in the middle of our fly trap. He seems to have figured he's safe there and that I can't reach him. But if you give him a wobble, he'll move around a bit. Well, we've been... And if you hear any buzzing, I see Bradley now cracking up in the studio. If you hear any buzzing, that means it's all his fault and not the Wasp. Well, I promised you I'd go on to our German news. Why is Germany beefing up its military? This headline from the BBC this morning. And they go with the atmospheric intro, so I'll read you the way they begin. It was an unseasonably mild morning as the sun rose slowly over the training range at Prabeda in Lithuania. This is effectively NATO's Eastern Front. Belarus is just a few kilometers away with Russia beyond. Lurking just outside the perimeter wire loom several Leopard battle tanks of a German armored battalion. So what are the Germans doing here? And what is the significance of this deployment for Berlin and for the Atlantic Alliance as a whole? Germany, they write, commands the NATO multinational battle group in Lithuania, intending to reassure a small ally in the face of a more assertive and aggressive Russia. They talk about how Germany is the framework nation in Lithuania. That means that they provide the headquarters and a significant number of troops for the NATO mission there. And then other NATO countries provide smaller troops that serve in this German-led force. They write that, well, they talk about how these troops are from Belgium, the Czech Republic, Luxembourg, Norway, and the Netherlands. And that's part of that whole battle group is part of the Lithuanian Brigade. And they write, Germany was not always so eager to put itself forward in military matters. So we talked about Japan remilitarizing. We're watching a similar trend going on in Germany. Revulsion at the horrors of Germany's Nazi past fostered a deep mistrust of militarism in the military, they write. But to a large extent, attitudes have been changing. So Germany's changing how it looks at the military. The German military was engaged in NATO's Kosovo operations and played a significant role in Afghanistan. But it was Russia's annexation of Crimea and its wider military intervention in eastern Ukraine that really began to shift German opinion. They quote the German Defense Minister, Ursula von der Leyen, saying that nowadays, having a large political relevance, being a certain economic power, we cannot shy away anymore. We have to say, because of our history, we have to get involved. And they talked about how more and more of the public are getting behind that view. And they write that this is only a prelude, this deployment in Lithuania, this is only a prelude to a larger NATO role. On the 25th of October, NATO's major exercise, Trident Juncture 18, kicks off in Norway. This, the alliance's biggest exercise since 2002, will be an opportunity for German forces in particular to show their capabilities before they assume the command of the alliance's very high readiness joint task force in 2019. For that year, German forces will be at the tip of NATO's spear. So they'll be commanding the rapid reaction forces that are meant to move and intervene quickly. It also talks about some of the challenges with Germany's military spending, how that really to keep up with the pace they're trying to set themselves, the German military needs to spend more, how some of their weapons are being need much more money spent on maintenance. But then they conclude, nevertheless, the shift in Germany's defense thinking is significant. It is a measure of the twin shocks of Vladimir Putin's assertiveness and Donald Trump's apparent questioning of the unity of NATO and the whole liberal order of which it is a part. So there's a shift in Germany's defense thinking, not just in the leaders, but in what the people of Germany are willing to support. And then here's an article. This was from German Foreign Policy yesterday. It was called The German Bomb. And they wrote that an advanced organization of Berlin government policy is driving the public debate on any nuclear armament of the EU or the Federal Republic. This Wednesday, so yesterday, the Society for the Security Policy is holding a high-caliber conference on the future of nuclear weapons in a world in disruption. So a world in disorder, and Germany is thinking and talking about nuclear weapons. One of the discussions is titled Renaissance of Nuclear Strategies. And there's also a discussion on a European's perspective on nuclear weapons. They talk about how there's a retired professor of political science who's advocating a German bomb, a German nuclear weapon. One of the subheads in that article is Atomic Superpower Europe. And they write, the new debate on building EU nuclear power on nuclear weapons in Germany gained momentum in November 2016 following Donald Trump's election victory. The rationale behind it from the beginning was that the unpredictable foreign policy of the new US president, his ambiguous position on NATO assistance guarantees, and in particular his critical stance on Germany and the EU, made it necessary to install an independent nuclear deterrent in Europe. Then they have some quotes from a few different people. I think we covered this in a Trumpet article around the same time, because you just had this explosion since that November 2016 election of people talking about Germany getting the bomb. So they quote Thorsten Benner, director of the Berlin Global Public Policy Institute. He had an article in Foreign Affairs in November 2016 where he wrote, Berlin will need to consider developing a European nuclear shield based on French and British capabilities. Then you also had Roderick Kesselwetter, who is the defense policy spokesman for the CDU-CSU parliamentary group, so a politician who's very influential in this. He talked about trying to create a European nuclear screen that all the EU would pay into, so there would be a European nuclear bomb. And then this is from German Foreign Policy. At the beginning of 2017, the new nuclear debate reached a temporary climax when a leading German newspaper triumphed that even Poland could not be expected to resist the project. The Polish government's grey eminence, Jarosław Kaczyński, had confirmed that he welcomed a future atomic superpower Europe. So even Poland was on board with an atomic superpower Europe. So there's a certain unrest in Germany, a desire for security, and a desire for a military, and even a nuclear bomb. And then earlier in the week, we heard about the turmoil in Germany politically after the Bavarian election. Here's a headline from the Times a couple of days ago on that subject, just following on some of the talk that's going on in Germany after the election in Bavaria on Sunday, where Angela Merkel's party, her sister party, took a beating. Their headline, Merkel's coalition on the brink after crushing blow in Bavaria election. And they write, this article writes, Angela Merkel's grand coalition is at risk of collapsing after both her junior partners in government suffered heavy electoral losses in Bavaria. Senior Social Democrats have urged their party to quit the government and reinvent itself in opposition after a dismal performance in which it finished fifth behind the far-right Alternative for Deutschland. It was the SDP's worst result in Bavaria since the end of the Second World War. So we've talked about how badly the CSU did, Angela Merkel's sister party. Equally as important is how badly the Social Democratic Party did. This is Germany's main left-wing party. You go back to the 90s and they were quite regularly getting 40% of the vote or more in some cases in some states. And they went down to 10% to coming fifth in Bavaria. And Germany's always had these other parties, these smaller parties, so it's not a perfect comparison, but it's almost as if the Democrats in America went from being the main left-wing party to getting 10% of the vote. That's a massive shift in German politics, and one that's making them very uncomfortable in being in this coalition with Angela Merkel. Just about the only thing that is keeping them there is that they're worried that if they have fresh elections, they'll do even worse. And now you've got this debate coming up in the state of Hesse in just a couple of weeks, and this could go badly for all the same people again. National poll ratings show that the SDP, this main left-wing party, nationwide, they could be polling on 15%. And coming in, they could come in behind some of these other parties, like the Green Party and the Alternative for Deutschland, going from Germany's main left-wing party to just some kind of minor party. So look at what you have going on in Germany. You have this political turmoil with all of this unrest and dissatisfaction and anger, but no one's really quite sure where to direct the anger and what to do about it, but just a lot of dissatisfaction and stirring. Then you've got the same kind of thing with the military, where opinions on Germany's military are stirring. Germany's military is getting more active abroad. People are even talking more and more about, well, do we need a nuclear bomb? Do we need to get Germany nuclear weapons? In the last but one Trumpet print edition, that was the one where they had the oil pipelines on the cover there. In his cover article, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, he drew attention to a scripture in Jeremiah 1 and verse 13, where Jeremiah says he sees a seething pot, and their face thereof is towards the north. And in that article, Mr. Flurry wrote, "This symbolic language is describing modern Germany. Beneath the surface, the nation is full of simmering dissatisfaction with the current world order. Germans are angry at the U.S. and especially furious with President Trump. The imperialistic ambition that prompted Germany to start both world wars is alive and well. It is seething." And that describes modern Germany today. He then went on to quote Jeremiah 1, verses 14 and 15, which says, "Then the Eternal said unto me, Out of the north an evil shall break forth upon all the inhabitants of the land. For lo, I will call the families of the kingdoms of the north, says the Eternal, and they shall come, and set everyone his thrones at the entrance at the gates of Jerusalem, and against all the walls thereof, and round about, and against all the cities of Judah." And Mr. Flurry writes, "America, Britain, and the Jewish nation, biblical Judah, and others should be alarmed by what is happening in Europe." He talked about how the events are setting the scene for the seething pot. And he wrote, "This boiling cauldron will scald everybody in America and Britain. This is prophesied to be the worst suffering ever known to man, and it will occur by God's hand because of his extreme wrath over the sins of these people." Repeatedly, God asked Jeremiah, "What do you see?" God is asking people today, "What do you see?" He doesn't say, "What do you read about this?" or "What do you hear about this?" What God says, "What do you see about this boiling cauldron?" Mr. Flurry continues, "Do you really see what is happening in Europe? Do you see the stage being set for a world war like never before? Do you understand it? God spells it out for us, and we can see events lining up with his prophecies. And anyone who sees it and heeds the warning and obeys God can be protected and lead a happy and stable and fulfilled life." And Mr. Flurry goes on to talk about how on the surface some of this news and this seething pot can seem depressing. But he writes, "But if you view it through the lens of Bible prophecy, you can clearly see that it is closely tied to the second coming of Jesus Christ." I'll just read a little more from this article. "Jesus Christ said in Matthew 24, verse 21 to 22, that if he didn't return, there should be no flesh saved alive. This is what Christ himself said when he was on this earth. It is written in red letters in your Bible. He knew what was coming." Now, Mr. Flurry talks about how it's clear that man cannot solve these problems that we see with all of these, or even problems with nuclear power, nuclear nations. And we see all of this building. And he concludes, God wants us to respond to him. He says he will help us in any way we need if we just obey him. Why will you die, O Israel? God asks in Ezekiel 18. He doesn't want any of us to have to suffer. He is eager to spare us from the coming cataclysmic violence and to bless us. We need to understand these Bible prophecies, he writes. They are preparing the way for the second coming of Jesus Christ to this earth. That means all the bad news is about to end. He is going to bring peace and joy and happiness to the world forever. And that's how he concludes that article. Like I said, you can go and read that if you want. It's in the previous but one, the cover article for the Trumpet Print, the previous but one article. And if you really want to understand what's going on and what's going on in Europe, and again, like I said at the end of the first half, to prove that to yourself, to prove to yourself that these scriptures are describing the modern world that we see around us, the news headlines that we see around us. Well, you can do that, and you can do that. We have a book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. And again, you can get that at our website, thetrumpet.com. You can read that for yourself, download it there, order a print copy there. Well, I haven't left myself much time for the third segment, so rather than have a couple of minutes break, I'll just go straight on into that and begin to introduce that. I have an article up on our website right now, Ukraine on Verge of Orthodox Jihad. And you're seeing some big developments going on in Ukraine. That article, the quip is, civil war in Ukraine that may now involve opposing Eastern Orthodox churches in open conflict. Andrew wrote this article, and he begins, in a religious and geopolitical earthquake, the Russian Orthodox Church severed ties with the Ecumenical Patriarchy of Constantinople on October 15th. And this is a big development in the world of religion. So there are 300 million Eastern Orthodox Christians. This is one of the biggest denominations. And they're splitting pretty much in half, because just about half of them belong to the Russian Orthodox Church, and then about half belong to the other Eastern Orthodox churches. And this religious conflict has been simmering ever since there was any kind of animosity between Russia and Ukraine, because Ukraine is part of the Orthodox Church in Ukraine comes under the overall authority, or came under the overall authority, of the Russian Orthodox Church. But just this week, or within the last couple of weeks, the Orthodox churches with the Patriarch in Constantinople has said that they're going to recognize the Orthodox Church as being kind of its own separate church in its own right, separate from the Russian Orthodox Church. And there have been a lot of people in Ukraine that have wanted this for a long time, and have been pushing for this for a long time, but that's a major blow for Russia. The head of the Russian Orthodox Church, I think it's still Metropolitan Kirill. Yes, it is. Metropolitan Kirill, Patriarch Kirill of Moscow. He's got very close ties to the government. There's some good evidence that he is at least a former KGB agent, part of Russia's secret service, heading up this church. So it's a major tool for them. And having control of the Ukrainian church under this overall Russian church has been of great advantage to them. But now it looks like that could be and is very likely to be splitting away. So they're threatening then to split from the rest of the Orthodox churches. Now, this is very important, very interesting, because for a long time we've been watching for these different Christian churches to all unify. Isaiah chapter 47 talks about this unification that will happen. It talks about a church called the Lady of Kingdoms that has power over many nations. And it talks about the protesting daughters, basically, of this mother church all coming back. And the Protestant churches, things like the Lutheran church, the Anglican Communion, they've made huge steps to this. So has the Orthodox churches. And they've come very close to full unity. Very, very close. They're not quite at the stage of complete intercommunion. It's very close, though. I think it's kind of like in life-threatening situations, communion with one can count. I can't remember the exact details, but they're very close to that. For the Orthodox church now to lose half of its members, and to be in open animosity with the Russian Orthodox Church, well, that could very well push them much closer to Rome and be much more willing to recognize the Pope and to come under his authority. And we've also said for years that the Russian Orthodox Church may well be an exception to the, all these churches being gathered in to the Roman Catholic Church, because that it's just so fundamental to the Russian nation and so strongly tied to the Russian government. And so with that kind of pressure pushing against the Catholic Church, now removed from all those Orthodox community, well, you could see those Orthodox churches now moving much closer to Rome. And however this turns out, a split in this 300 million strong Christian community is a very big deal and another very important news event. So, like I mentioned, you can read much more about that on our website, Ukraine on Verge of Orthodox Jihad. That was an article by Andrew Miller. And again, that book that I mentioned earlier, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, is just a great place to go where you can learn much more about what the Bible prophesies about the Catholic Church. Proving, and again, that book will prove to you, don't just take my word for it, it will prove to you that Isaiah 47 is talking about the Catholic Church. It will show you where the Catholic Church is prophesied in your Bible, and you can go through all of those scriptures yourself. Well, that's it about it from me. You can keep listening here on kpcg.fm and at 101.3 on the FM dial. Mr. Stephen Flurry should be back again tomorrow presenting, and you can keep any comments coming at td@kpcg.fm.